You're listening to Access Minnesota. Now, here's Jim Dubois.
Our guest is Wilma Kutstall. She is a cognitive neuroscientist and psychology professor at the University of Minnesota. She's the author of the book, The Agile Mind. It's out on Oxford University Press. Also the author of the upcoming book, Agile Minds, Agile Organizations, A Thinking Framework for Creativity and Change. Professor Kutstall, your last book titled The Agile Mind received wide praise from other scholars and won the American Psychological Association's prestigious 2012 William James Book Award, which honors exceptional books that bring a unique and interdisciplinary approach to the field of psychology. William James, who is called the father of American psychology, was a major early influence on your research. Tell us about that.
Yes, I'd love to talk about James. He was a very deep influence on me. You described him as the father of American psychology, but people also realize that he's a very important American philosopher, and his training actually was in medicine. So he was a very multi-talented person. He thought very deeply about a lot of questions, and I think probably one of his most enduring influences on me was his treatment or his thinking about thinking and what are concepts and how do we use them. And he was very disturbed by how some of the main thinkers in his day were what he described as overly abstract, or he used the term actually vicious abstractionism, which is when we kind of become so enamored with our ideas in some ways. We reify our ideas and don't sort of tap into our common sense knowledge so he had very memorable ways of talking about concepts. He talked about how we need abstract concepts to sort of handle our perceptual particulars by, and so we kind of are continually moving between different levels of abstraction, or in the ideal world, that's what we're doing. Like, so we move up to abstractions because abstractions allow us to cover kind of larger ranges of experience, different kinds of experience. But then if we stay up there too much, then we sort of lose contact with experience. And so we need to kind of move up, move across, and then come back down again. It's a very metaphorical way of thinking about what abstraction is, but it's actually very helpful. And in fact, that's one of the great things. James was a wonderful writer, and that is one of the reasons I think he is such a powerful writer, is that he finds the right metaphors that help us think about things. And this notion of us as kind of wading in particulars, that's when we're kind of caught or mired in the details, and we have to move up and kind of skip across some of the information and then come back down again. And there's that kind of continual moving up and moving down. Another big influence that he had, or two influences on my thinking, were he really emphasized the importance of kind of the relations between things. So thinking isn't just about the objects, but it's also about how this relates to that. And there's a diagram in one of his books of kind of like, well, what is it to hear a clap of thunder? And it's not just to hear the clap of thunder, it's the quiet before and then the quiet after. And there's kind of this transition across our experience, and the experience is not just the clap of thunder, it really is about the relations between the pieces. And so he talked about that in other contexts as kind of flights and perchings, and we want to kind of capture how our minds work, both when they're perched, when they're kind of settled where they're going to be, and also when they're kind of in flight.
Tell us about some of the more insightful studies that you've seen or been a part of, which illuminate our understanding of how creativity and mental agility work.
Wow, that's a huge question and really, really fun. I think a sort of preface to answering that question is that whatever ones I choose, the next day I might choose different ones, or I might choose and there's so many different reasons to choose studies. So one reason to choose studies is kind of that they were formative in thinking about some issues. So, for example, one of the studies I encountered early on and that I still think is quite important is a study done by psychologist Daniel Wegner. And early on, he talked about something called action identification. And the best way to kind of talk about what that is like, imagine that I've invited you into the testing room, and you happen to be a coffee drinker, and I say, here's a cup of coffee, have a drink of this coffee, we've prepared it as you like it, and you go to take a sip, and the cup is much heavier than usual. And then I ask you to describe, you take a sip, and I ask you to describe, what did you just do? And if it was a very heavy cup, you would tend to describe it in terms of lower level, more concrete things, like I was bringing the cup to my lips, I was swallowing. But if it was a normal coffee cup like you usually experience, then you would tend to describe that same activity at a higher level of abstraction, like I was satisfying my caffeine habit, I was getting energized, or whatever terms we would use, but much more like kind of cross-situational, more abstract than if it was a heavy cup. And Daniel Wegner and other researchers studied action identification quite extensively, and we're making choices in terms of how we construe our actions. Like, so right now, for example, I could say, well, I'm speaking to you and I'm trying to enunciate clearly and so forth. I'm saying syllables, that's true, but I'm also doing lots of other things at different levels of abstraction, like trying to convey to you the idea that we have different levels of abstractness in which we consider our actions and our goals. So I'll call it the coffee cup experiment. I would say that was definitely it's a favorite, and I think conveys a lot to us. Other examples, earlier you asked about resilience and what is resilience and so forth, and this is also an early study by researchers at the University of Berkeley. They did longitudinal studies of children and looking at who tended to be more resilient, and based on their parents' descriptions and observations and so forth, they classified children into children who were kind of over-controlled, like they're always kind of careful, always cautious, always holding themselves in. There were children who were under-controlled. We probably all know what that looks like, the ones that have tantrums, the ones that give in to impulse right away, who say what they shouldn't say, those. And then there were what they called resilient, were neither over-controlled controlled nor under controlled, but moved between those in kind of a context appropriate way. So in certain contexts, it's true, we should be more controlled. In certain circumstances, that's what's required and is beneficial for everyone. In other cases, though, it actually is not beneficial to stay super controlled. And in those cases, it's helpful to us and to our physiology and to our minds to let go a little bit. And so another wonderful thing about the study is they looked at these children across time. And so early on, maybe the children who were over-controlled looked like they were doing as well as the sort of resilient children. But across time, that was not so much the case anymore, and including their academic performance. And over-control could be detrimental in the sense that, like we talked earlier about being too perfect or wanting to have more control than you can have, and that could be detrimental. Can I have one more example? We haven't talked a lot about the brain, and of course we know that there's lots of research on the brain. It has been for decades, different methodologies and so forth, and I would not have wanted to be a participant in this study, not because of the fMRI environment, but just because of the complexity of the task requirements. But this is a study that asked people to perform different tasks, but they had different rules for the tasks. So in some cases, the rule would be something quite simple, like if there's a red square, press one button. If there's a blue square, press a different button. That would be the kind of the most concrete, the most kind of straightforward type of rule. In other cases, the rules got more complex. So it would be kind of, if there's a certain color frame around something and the color is this, then you should do this. So what you had to do there is kind of take into account not just one thing to another thing, but kind of a context to a further thing. So it's kind of a higher order rule, like, or if you're in this context, this is what you should do. But if you're now over at if you're at grandma's house, this is what you do. But if you're at my house, this is what you do. Like, so this idea that we have situations or higher order kind of groupings of rules as well as and what this study showed was that as the rules that you were trying to keep in mind and you're actually performing this task in the scanner, that if it was a very concrete and sort of simple type of rule, activity was found in frontal cortex nearer to where our representation of actions and motor activity is. But if it was a more complex rule, as it became increasingly complex or abstract, activity kind of moved forward in the brain. So when it was the most abstract, it was about relations of relations of relations that you're trying to keep in mind. Activity was kind of right at the front of your brain in the frontal pole. And there's other aspects about that study that are really incisive and very analytical and really beautifully done. And so I think that's a favorite too.
How can we improve our mental agility?
Oh, many ways, I think. Okay, so maybe one of the easiest ways, I think, is to start by thinking about mental agility as not so much in our heads as in our environments. So ask yourself about your environment, and is your environment helping you to bring to mind the things that you want to bring to mind when you want to bring them to mind? So sometimes our environments are cueing our thinking about things that have nothing to do with what we want to do now, like so maybe we should just move those away, or we have lots of control over our environment and whether we can capture ideas very quickly. Like, so we talked earlier about we're always in a mental accessibility landscape or an idea landscape. Well, part of that is ideas come up and bubble up into awareness, but then sometimes they're there just kind of momentarily and then they disappear again. And so advice that people have for increasing kind of creativity is to capture the ideas as they happen. So be ready to capture them. And that's sort of a generic piece of advice that people have given, like from poets to people who study creativity. And so there's famous examples of that, like the poet Wallace Stevens. He used to walk a lot, which is also a good way to have ideas come to mind, doing something that's kind of habit. He walked to and from his office every day. But he always had envelopes in his pocket, and he'd kind of write down phrases that came to mind when he was walking. And he had a place in his desk that the bottom desk drawer was open a little bit, and he'd slip things in there. So one way to increase our mental agility is to think about our environment and whether it's working for us or working against us. And there are other ways that we can make it more amenable to our thinking processes. We think about words as kind of ideas, words as very mental in some ways, but words are also very physical. Maybe as a broadcaster, you do realize that words are like they're extended in time, they're an auditory thing, etc. But we also have control over kind of how once we put words on the page, they're now out there, they're in the environment. I can manipulate them if I've thought about how to put them on the page or what, and there might be different modalities that it's useful for me to be kind of working with the words. Once I put them out there in the environment, then I don't have to hold them on in my mind in working memory, and now I can see relations. I can bring my perceptual strengths to bear and see patterns that maybe I didn't see before because now it's out there. And I'm not holding it all in here. I'm kind of letting my natural abilities to see patterns and notice similarity, notice differences kind of come forward.
We've been talking with Wilma Kutstall. She's a cognitive neuroscientist and psychology professor at the University of Minnesota. She's the author of the book, The Agile Mind. It's on Oxford University Press, and the author of the upcoming book, Agile Minds, Agile Organizations, A Thinking Framework for Creativity and Change. Professor Kutstall, thanks so much for joining us on Access Minnesota.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Access Minnesota will return after these messages.
Thanks for joining Golden Gopher Fanatics. Our guest today is a scarecrow, and he's kept a close watch on some innovative University of Minnesota developments.
That sounds interesting. I can't wait to meet him.
Okay. Explain for us why you consider yourself to be one of the U of M's biggest fans.
You see, ever since the U of M got together with Winfield part of a land of lakes. The crops I oversee couldn't be more beautiful.
Right. Well, Winfield is recruiting the U of M's brightest and best students of agriculture to help illuminate better insights and advanced technologies, which is leading to higher yields for farmers.
Is that right?
Yes, and this translates to more jobs and a stronger state economy. I thought you might already be aware of this, considering it's happening right under your nose.
Under my nose? They're over my head. These crops just keep on growing and growing and growing.
The U of M and Land O'Lakes, partnering to illuminate possibilities. Discover how at umn.edu.